If you're tired of one-sided conversations and mean-spirited rhetoric, it's time to listen and engage. This is The Rational Revolution, a look at today's issues through a politically purple lens. Now here's your host, Chris Elfheim.
Well, hello, friends. Welcome back to The Rational Revolution. This is Chris Elfheim. I'm very happy to be here with you with my guest host, Mr. Tony Palmieri. Say hello.
Hello, Chris, and hello to our audience.
Hello, hello. We are excited to have you. Welcome to Rational Revolution, where we try our best to look at issues from multiple perspectives, not just the one we know well, but maybe sometimes what we don't know well. Take everything into consideration, add a little salt, and be better people for it. Today, I'm excited we have a guest on, Dr. Reverend Susan Cartmell. We're going to talk a little religion, and that's going to carry over into religion and politics, so we're going to break both rules right away. But it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it. It should be a great conversation. In the meantime, Tony, what's happened in the last week? What do you want to talk about?
I guess we should talk about the kind of non-rational revolution going on in Washington, D.C. right now, if we, you don't mind me calling it that, where Kevin McCarthy was forced out of the Speaker of the House of Representatives position after only, I believe, 72 days in that position.
Didn't it take him 12 times to get into the position?
Like 12 votes, maybe 15.
Who saw this coming? Time.
Yeah. Well, and in order to become Speaker back in January, he had to agree to allow any one member of the House to put forth a motion to vacate the Speaker position, which pretty much guaranteed it was going to happen. And so it was essentially eight Republicans, most of them huge Donald Trump fans and supporters, that filed the motion. And of course, Speaker McCarthy got no support from the Democrats in the Congress. And
do you question that a little bit?
No, well, I've been watching mainstream news media coverage of this, and some people are saying, you know, maybe the Democrats should have stepped in to quote unquote rescue McCarthy. But really, what would have been in that for him?
Well,
for them.
I think the Democrats leaned in. I'm not sure they helped McCarthy. I think they helped the nation in making sure the government didn't shut down, which I think was great. But and then, you know, my understanding is that they didn't back him because McCarthy immediately went on the mic and blamed the Democrats or something, which is dumb. But now what situation are we in? Now look at it. They're talking about putting up Jordan. Is that the guy we want leading?
No.
Good heavens.
No.
So, I don't know. Dysfunction. We talk about accountability and being able to work together to get things done. What we're witnessing, you know, in Madison and in D.C., that ain't it.
Right.
That's not it.
Yeah, so, it was really interesting. The eight members of Congress most opposed to McCarthy, as you suggest, were most upset that he worked to keep the government open.
Yeah.
Which really was his job.
When you're the faction of the party, and I'm careful to say that because I think it is just there's always a small, you know, faction that causes the chaos. But what they want is chaos.
Yeah.
What they want is chaos. What they want is the markets and the economy to go crazy so that they can point the finger at the guy sitting at the chair doing it. Yeah. It's just all games. My issue is that this entire conversation of spending in this, they're only dealing with about 24% of the budget.
Yeah.
24% of the budget, 25% of the budget is the entire portion of all the money that the government spends is actually controllable by Congress. And of that 24-25%, 50% of it is for the military and the FBI. So there are issues. There are issues in our government. We've got some overlap. We've got some duplication. We've got some stuff that's going on. But they're kicking and screaming over the smallest portion of it. They're not actually addressing some of the major issues that we have, which is in the other 75% of the budget that we realistically have a population that we're struggling to maintain our benefits for. So how are we going to address it?
Good point. And, you know, they're really not credible on the deficit. They claim they're upset about deficit spending, but they only seem to be worried about that when there's a person of a different party in the White House.
I would agree with that.
When the Trump tax cuts rose the deficit by, $1 trillion or more? somehow they were not upset about deficits at that point.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think deficit spending is something we need to be concerned about, but you have to be consistent on it.
Yeah, I think that's valid. And it is definitely the case on both sides, even though, you know, whether we should be involved. You know, I'm not an expert on things foreign, but, you know, the whole Ukraine conversation right now, you know, I believe in trying to help people not get murdered. You know, I believe in helping societies and defending against that kind of injustice. And I think the bulk of the population does. It amazes me how sometimes one party seems to be in favor of staying in a foreign country and mm-hmm. the next time they're not.
Right.
So what drives that? Wasn't there a big, you know, hullabaloo about pulling out of Afghanistan recently?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, in recent history. So again, I think it's all wishy-washy depending on, I'm just checking on our guest here, depending on where you're at and where we are in politics. And that's just a challenge.
Yeah, there should be a good debate about what percentage of money going to Ukraine should be for humanitarian assistance and how much should be military.
Exactly.
But those renegade members of Congress are not really interested in that debate.
Right.
Right. They seem to be most interested in making Joe Biden look bad. And I think unless we move away from that kind of debate, I don't think we're really going to make that much progress.
No, I think that's true. And off of this national subject, now talk a little bit about local, something that you're involved with. You are a current professor down at UW Oshkosh.
I am.
You had a little action on that. Talk about what went on down there.
Well, on this past Tuesday, there was a protest against some severe budget cuts. We are probably going to lose 200 to 300 positions at UW Oshkosh this month. And there's great frustration. The UW, as you know, has been defunded now for many years. Our current administration on the campus is perceived by most faculty and staff as not doing enough to frame it as this is a Madison problem. It's not that we have not been spending like reckless sailors at UW Oshkosh.
Yeah.
Not at all. And so we were there. I mean, I was there in support of my colleagues, many of whom will probably lose their job this month. So it's terrible. But it was great, Chris. There were professors, members of the academic staff. There were a ton of students. Everyone was making great points about the role of education, the need to support it. It really was, Chris, a rational revolution in the street.
Yeah.
I mean, people were making so many impassioned, common sense type of points.
Yeah.
And we left there hoping that the administration of our campus had gotten the message, and hopefully the representatives in Madison get the message also. I mean, who benefits if a university fails?
Not society.
Right.
I mean, not society. And there are issues. There's so many people that talk about expense and cost and taxpayers and this and that, but I would just want you to imagine for a second if we didn't have them.
Yeah. Did you see the report in the New York Times early this week that apparently people with college degrees on average live 8 years longer, right? Which is amazing. So that would suggest to me that a decent society would try to get people educated. I mean, if it is correlated with longevity of lifestyle.
I'd throw some water on that fire just because you also have a whole class of people that never have an opportunity to get there.
But we should give them the opportunity.
Yeah.
Not everyone has to go. Yeah, not everyone wants it.
I would think that would be true if you could show that somebody had financial security and stability throughout their life. They would live 8 years longer than someone who didn't.
Right.
Whether that be found in the trades, whether that be found in college, it's just giving them the opportunity to find success in life. And I think that all of these things are good. I'm not a believer that everyone needs to go through a university to find success. I am not that person. I think that the trades are fantastic. I think there's an entrepreneur level. I think there are great opportunities. But we must have the systems to provide those opportunities.
No, I agree with all of that. But one of the problems we have is that there are too many people who want to go that have been priced out of it. And that's a problem. Anyone who wants to go should be able to go.
I've been a proponent, and I talked about this in my campaign. I'm a proponent of, you know, the economy and education system should work together.
Yeah.
And we're doing that on a manufacturing level. We do that in terms of the trades right now. There's heavily invested into the industries, the manufacturing companies that need workers are now in the schools, in the tech schools. There's a lot of help on that. I think the reality is we're also short on teachers. We're also short on nurses. We're short on a lot of different people.
We are.
And I wish that there were some type of a grant kickback system where you earn your degree, you stay in Wisconsin, you work in that field for a period of time, yeah. and then you've earned that wipe out of debt. I think that would be a win-win across the air. All right, we're going to put a pin in that, and we're going to start transitioning. I believe our guest is on the line. If I say, I'm going to call out your name, and if you're with me, say amen. We are looking for, I'm so excited. Well, you're so excited to have our guest with us. We have Dr. Reverend Susan Cartmell with us calling in from Boston. Is that correct? Are you with me?
I'm with you.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. I miss you, my friend. I'm excited to have you on the call. I mean, how many times do you have somebody that's on a little talk radio show say, hey, why don't you come on and talk religion with us on the radio, and maybe we'll blend that in with a little politics?
It's pretty rare. Thank you for thinking of it.
I mean, if we throw sex in there, that's the trifecta that you're not supposed to talk about, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
We got it all then.
All right. Yeah. So give us...
The ratings will just go through the roof.
Yeah. Or we'll never hear from us again.
One or the other.
Sounds like, yeah, that one. All right. So give us a little bit about your background. I know about you, but share with the crowd, you know, who you are, where you come from, and how we're getting here.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to have a conversation. I'm a minister in the United Church of Christ. And the United Church of Christ is a very progressive religion. It's a Protestant denomination where we believe the tagline is that everybody's welcome, no matter who you are or where you are on life's journey. And we also believe that God's not done with us. God's still speaking. So that means that history informs us, but our faith isn't locked in the past.
That's awesome. That's awesome. We got about a minute before we head into our break and then get into an in-depth conversation with our guest here, Dr. Reverend Susan Cartmell. You know, just to kind of kick things off before we head into break, this is going to be a conversation about religion that is all positive. There's nothing that's going to go on in this conversation that is anti this or anti that. We just want to kind of talk through kind of what's going on in today's situation and how that implies across the board. We are very, very excited to have Dr. Susan with us. Hang on as we head into break. As a reminder, we are talking live here from WGBW, the Talk of Green Bay, 98.3 Oshkosh Air Support as well. And don't forget Civic Media. Please text us in. This is going to be a good one. Religion, politics, rational revolution. Come on back. Welcome back, everybody, to the Rational Revolution. This is Chris Alfheim, my guest host, Mr. Tony Palmieri. And on the line with us, we have Dr. Reverend Susan Cartmell coming in out of Boston to talk religion with us. So, Reverend Susan, let's get at the conversation. You and I chatted a while back, and we were talking about kind of where, you know, religion lies right now and some of the tension, the tension that exists. And, you know, there's some anger, there's division, and we talked a little bit about your interpretation of the Old Testament and how perhaps talking about that might remind us and reset us a little bit. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, the people that call themselves Christian and use their religion to talk about politics so much in our media, I think have forgotten that the Bible is just full of all kinds of different voices.
Yeah.
That the Bible has so many different expressions of faith. It's not unilateral. And the overarching theme in Old Testament and New Testament stories, but especially in the Old Testament, sets a groundwork for remembering the poor, paying attention to justice, and listening to the people who don't have a voice. And the people, that's the theme of the Bible. And so it's ironic that so many people are using their faith to discriminate about all number of things, but often discriminate against different people of color, people who are coming into this country from another place. There's a long tradition in the Old Testament, especially, that you're supposed to welcome the stranger with open arms. In fact, create a special meal for them, take care of them, nurture them, and see in this new person, the immigrant, the sojourner, you name it, a representation of the face of God.
Mm.
And so you greet the stranger as you would greet an angel or a messenger that has come to you on purpose from God. And all those sorts of messages are sort of lost in so many debates about, for example, immigration or how we treat one another.
Social justice, that type of stuff. It seems like it's, you know, from your interpretation, it seems like a much more humble approach to the world than what many of us feel, you know, is talked about. I mean, if you turn on the radio, not these channels, but if you turn on a number of the channels in the daytime, that's not what I'm hearing. That's not what's being broadcast out there. Do you think that there was a change or there was a period of time when that transitioned, or has it always been this way?
It's interesting because I was trying to think about that very question this morning. So I guess we're all on the same page here. When did this change? I mean, was there a time when, and throughout history, there's always been this intersection between faith and religion, and some people have used their faith for power, and some people have used, even in the Middle Ages, people have used their faith to gain access to the halls of power or to control people. Mm-hmm. But then running through religion, there's also been this whole strain or genre of people who were humbled by their faith and came at it from a whole different perspective.
Would you say
and
that
right now,
oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Would you say that in say recent history, the emergence of Reverend Falwell and the Moral Majority in the 80s, did that seem to be a movement toward moving away from a progressive theology, like a Martin Luther King social justice? And it seems to me, I was in college in the early 80s, and it seems to me that's when public thought about religion became, it's very conservative, it's very judgmental, it's negative toward the immigrants and so on. What would you say about that?
You're right. That's one of the examples of how the pendulum swung over to the right. And what I understand is that in the early part of the 1900s, in the 1920s, the 1930s, there were big debates between progressive and fundamentalist pastors. Like the New York Times ran sermons of famous preachers, Fosdick and some of the others, as there was this sort of open dueling between pulpits in New York City.
Yeah.
And in those days, the progressives won, and the people who were more conservative, who kind of lost the debate, decided to go underground and leave New York City and go all over the country to seed a movement that we've seen now.
Wow.
And
wow.
Create this ground up surge of much more conservative faith.
Mm-hmm.
It was strategic and effective. And you're right. It came out with people like Falwell. That was like the beginning of this incredible movement that has made people think there's only one way to be Christian, and it's that way.
Yeah.
Reverend, I have a question. We have about 1 minute before we head into our next break, but how do you feel about, or help us understand the one issue voter? There's so many people that their issue may be pro-life, and it's the only thing that matters. Help me understand how that can be.
It's a combination of very conservative Protestants and Roman Catholics who've come together to create the, I don't even want to call it a pro-life movement because it's not, but the anti-abortion movement.
Yeah.
They have joined forces and found their strength in that.
We might have to dig back into that. We've got about 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Listen, we are with here Dr. Susan and Reverend Cartmell talking religion and politics. We'll be back on the backside. That's my favorite lead-in song. Welcome back to the Rational Revolution. I'm Chris Elf. I'm here with my guest host, Mr. Tony Palmieri. We have a great guest on today. We have the Dr. Reverend Susan Cartmell coming live to us from Boston, Massachusetts. And we are talking religion mixed in with a little bit of politics. Next, we're going to, I'm going to leave the last conversation alone, but I think what we're trying to talk about is things we understand, things we don't understand about what's going on in religion. And let's just kind of start there. You know, I know that you have just gotten done writing a book, and, you know, let's just talk a little bit about what's been changing. You know, what are people asking for? What are they looking for in their religion? Are they getting it? Are churches and are we struggling to find the spot? Just what's the status right now?
We did just finish writing a book. My wife and I are writing a book about how the pandemic didn't really change churches, but lifted up some of the issues that churches have been struggling with for a long time. And they became issues that you couldn't avoid anymore and had to look at because of the pandemic or during the pandemic.
Such as what?
Well, people aren't so interested, we discovered, in worrying about who's a member of the church. They just want churches to do good work. Mm. They want churches to do good work in the community. Mm. And one of the things that opened up because of the pandemic is that a lot of congregations discovered that there were people going hungry in their community when the schools shut. And so there was this whole movement across the country. We interviewed pastors, 53 pastors from Cape Cod to Alaska, and all across the country, people got involved in helping feed people. You didn't have to be a member of the church. You didn't have to participate in it, and you didn't or to receive the food. It was this sort of groundswell of feeling that everybody's my neighbor and we're in this together. And it made a huge difference. There were clothing drives. There were diaper drives. There were groceries handed out.
It's interesting because as you're talking about the community, there's so many people that historically have, in fact, last week, Pam Yonke from the Midwest Farm Report talked about church in the rural areas really being a number one community. And it feels like what you're describing is that the community itself realized that they were only a small part of the larger one. And they started looking out to help others. And I think that's something that we all have to look at. We're in our little silos of what's going on. And if we allow ourselves to look out, then are we willing to help those with those beliefs that we share? Are we willing to reach across and help someone that may not look like us? They may not live in the same capacity, but are we not in charge of doing good by them?
Right, exactly. What we discovered was that people didn't worry so much about what they believed. They worried about getting the job done and helping people live together. And in some cases, some churches even reimagined who they were. There's a church in Alaska that we write about in the book that was real small and made such a difference in their community that they created a community center as part of their mission. And they're bringing everyone in the town together to help each other. And that sort of redefined this Methodist church in a new way.
I think there's, it's also important to talk about, there's differences in people that sit on a pew on any given Sunday. But I think some people mm-hmm. sit in a pew because they're looking to fill their own bucket. And some people are in the pew because they're looking to help others fill theirs. And in a perfect world, we would all do both.
Right.
So it's a challenge.
Well, it looked like one of the things the pandemic did was revealed to many people the disparities in healthcare and the disparities because of race, the disparities in our nation around several key issues of getting what you need to survive.
Yeah.
And churches became a key part of a different approach. And that has been, that was one of the things that we discovered. Churches made a huge difference in this pandemic.
As you did your research and found out about these great works going on that you're talking about and talked to those pastors, did it give you the sense that the pendulum is swinging, that we will start thinking once again more broadly as the church, as a church of social justice or a progressive church?
I think that progressive churches found a different identity and a stronger sense of purpose. The more conservative churches are the loudest still in many ways, but it's interesting how at the ground level, all these other types of churches, big and small, found that people were looking for a new kind of faith community, and they were open to changing. And they were eager to respond when the church had a kind of open message.
Mm-hmm.
Church in Connecticut, this woman said that whenever she went to a gay pride event, she got new members for her church. She didn't mean to. She just went there to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But it made a difference, and people would show up in the pews the next Sunday.
As a reminder, everybody, we are talking to Dr. Reverend Susan Carmel, and you're welcome to text in. I know Dr. Susan well enough that she wouldn't even mind answering a question. So shoot us a text if you want to talk. Again, we're talking religion, you know, what it means to you, what are you missing, what do you wish, and then, again, a little blend of politics in there as well. I would like to talk, if we can, a little bit about top down versus bottom up. I think that in politics, in society today, you know, we've got this concept right now, again, kind of money, power is in charge, and then everybody else is underneath, and there's an imbalance going on right now for sure. So let's just talk about that and how that relates to religion or faith in general.
Well, many churches operate with a top-down model and have historically, like for generations. Certainly the Roman Catholic Church is probably the prime example. But many churches follow that model. But it looks at, that's another example of something that people have questioned, especially during the pandemic, because so many people in congregations felt like they were on their own to figure it out. And many weren't getting a lot of direction from their denominations because nobody knew what to do. So it ended up being a bottom-up sort of experience for so many people. They tried things they'd never tried before. They were much more adventurous, mm-hmm. and they were trial and error in many cases. But it's also caused many people to question that kind of hierarchical structure. I think the clergy themselves, in some cases.
Yeah. C- Can we talk a little bit? Can we talk a little Catholicism for a second?
I'm an old Catholic boy.
I'm an old Catholic.
I'm outnumbered now.
No, I'm an old former one. But there in this week's news, you know, it's kind of a big deal. This Pope has definitely pushed some buttons.
He has.
And he is allowing, first, I'm not sure I knew there were female bishops, but woohoo, they get to vote. So let's talk a little bit about where the Catholic Church is, if you can, and what do you see or feel is going on?
I think there's been a push for a long time in many parts of the Catholic Church to bring some new ideas in. They're struggling to fill their positions. They don't have enough clergy. And so that's part of it. They've allowed married deacons to take roles throughout the Midwest, but all over the country, to take the roles of priests to try and stopgap this kind of... Well, the Catholic Church has been so affected by the clergy abuse scandal.
Absolutely.
It's devastated them, not just the bad PR, but the lack of trust and the financial implications that came with all the lawsuits that are still going on.
Yeah.
So in our neighborhood here in Boston, the biggest piece of real estate is owned by a cathedral that's been boarded up for the entire time that I have lived here. For 15 years, this cathedral is boarded up, and the windows were taken out, and it's this reminder of the cost of what's gone on and what continues to go on. And unfortunately, at its worst, sex abuse is an example of power that's unchecked.
There's no doubt. Yeah. I mean, power can be abused and is abused often, and it's certainly not affecting only the Catholic Church. There are a multitude of documentaries and stories out there on some of these mega church pastors and, you know, stuff that's gone on. Why, you know, talk about a difference. You've got the traditional Catholic kind of model, and now you have these mega churches. Just can we talk about the mega church a little bit and what the allure is and, you know, what's the difference and what's your perspective on those?
There was a book that was written like around 2000 by a church authority, a guy who studied churches. And he said, you know, churches are going to have to become more like malls.
Oh, great.
People like malls because they have variety, and the whole family can go to the mall and go to different stores and get what they need. And so mega churches are an example of that kind of religion where the whole family goes to a big church and gets many different needs met. The child goes to the class, the parents go to the Bible study. There's something for everyone. And it's big, and that's really the only way you offer that kind of variety and pay for it is if you have a large organization.
Yeah.
And that was a model. I mean, the Rick Warren model of how to build a church, he built his in Saddleback, Orange County, California. But, and that was copied by many, 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 many people. It's also kind of an ego trip for the pastor.
Yeah.
So every pastor really wanted to do that.
Pastors as rock stars.
Yeah. And you have a lot of power.
Absolutely.
And you attract a lot of people. But talk about top down. One reason that none of those churches are democracies.
No.
They just aren't. And, but those churches often run because people are given an enemy, someone to hate. There's nothing that unifies people better than giving them an enemy.
That's so sad. So true, but so sad.
It is sad. Yeah. We got about a minute left on this side. We're going to, when we come back from the break, we're going to hit this question. A text came in. I think it's a great one. It says, one of the themes you mentioned in the Old Testament related to hospitality resonated with me. How do we continue to support individuals in our communities to be more visible outside the bricks and mortar of the church? Protecting the bricks and mortar seems to be part of the problem. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
This is a great question.
This is fun. We're talking religion. Who thought this would be a good topic? But yeah. I think it is. I think we should be talking and learning again. This is Chris Alf. I'm Rational Revolution. Thanks for being here on 97.9 The Talk of Green Bay, 98.3 Oshkosh Air Support. Don't forget the app. You can text in as well. We'll see you on the flip side. Welcome back to the Rational Revolution. I'm Chris Alf. I'm here with my guest host, Tony Palmieri, and our guest on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. We have the Dr. Reverend Susan Cartmell. And we left at the end of the break with a text that had come in. And I will say again, the question is, how do we continue to support individuals in our communities to be more visible outside the brick and mortar of the church? And protecting the brick and mortar seems to be part of the problem. Interesting.
It's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went to the break, I was thinking about the story in the Old Testament that I think is kind of the primordial story about hospitality. It's Abraham. And Abraham was visited by these three strangers. And he told his wife, Sarah, to make them a wonderful meal. And he started helping work on that with her. But they both worked together to make this meal, and then they sat down, and the stranger said, your dream is going to come true. You're going to have a family. They were old, and they thought that ship had sailed. And so they did. But the story takeaway is you should welcome strangers and show hospitality for a lot of reasons. It's the right thing to do. That's why they did it. But then also, you may find a gift in that welcoming that you didn't expect.
Mm.
And over in the Bible, there's those sorts of moments where when you do the right thing, the reward may not come in the way you expected, but
yeah,
there is a reward in it. And one of the prime examples is how you welcome other people affects the gifts that God can give to you and that you find in life, just find.
Yeah.
Now, brick and mortar has been the reason that's one of the things we found in the book too. We got one of our quotes is from a fellow who really questions whether churches have gotten too invested in their buildings. Mm. The cost is high. And the question is, how are they going to use those spaces? And maybe God's calling them to go out and reimagine the space or leave it and try to do something else outside.
I mean, it's difficult. In the end, every organization has to have operating costs and staff.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, even though we're talking about, you know, an organization that is just trying to do good for their people and the community, the bottom line is it still costs a lot of money. It does. And I think
right.
that a lot of
it's
us...
like running a small business.
Right. I think a lot of us feel that it's a never-ending ask now. Whether it be church, and I'm on the stewardship committee at our church. So we're either asking for money for church, we're asking for money for the homeless, we're asking for money for dogs, we're asking for money for politics. And I think that there's an exhaustion. There's an exhaustion level from the public. So how do we reconcile that when it comes to a church that we believe is trying to do good?
Well, that's a hard one because if you have no place to gather, then you lose your identity and you can lose your congregation.
Yeah.
Because they come together for a reason and they are fed by the gathering. So I don't think that necessarily, I don't know if it's practical to ignore the importance of having a place. I guess the question is how you use the place maximally and make sure that it's not driving the mission and vision of what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, just maintenance.
So you get
and that's strictly balanced.
We got a, it always is. So we got a couple minutes left. Let's talk about, you know, the religion and politics just a little bit. What would you say if you could do anything to help depolarize our political world from your perspective? So from the perspective of faith, what do you, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to create some civility?
This is a crazy idea. So I'll just preface it with that.
They're my favorite.
I would like to have some kind of a Peace Corps with a religious perspective. You know, it's interesting. The Mormons send their youth out on a mission that is fraught with, that's sort of foolish because they don't, they're supposed to be, they go out in twos and they go out as young people to supposedly recruit, but they never get very many people in these recruiting things. But the experience changes the people who go.
Yes.
And so I kind of would like to put together teams of people that are explicitly interfaith, you know, a very fervent Jewish youth, a very fervent Catholic, a really a person who's Protestant, who's really a believer in some ways, and maybe some agnostics. And make a team of them and give them a project to do in some community where their work is needed.
And
maybe those sorts of experiences would help build a more humane generation.
What a great idea.
It is a great idea, and it goes hand in hand with that whole bottoms-up concept.
And I work with young people at a public university, and as you know, young people have really fallen away from the institutional church, and there's such a spiritual void. And I think because young people are not interested in getting dogma top down, they would rather be involved in a community doing the kinds of things that you just mentioned in your, you know, your Peace Corps idea. So I think we need that. I would think especially for the young people.
Well, I think this is where, you know, I would hope that the conversation of faith, again, and I'm a believer in faith. The lane that you choose, I'm okay with. But theoretically, there should be something in common, which again, this bottoms up mentality of taking care of people. And if we just had that and we could believe in all of the different organizations believing in the same model, you know, just imagine what we would do if we all pulled together for the same good, which is for the good of people.
Yeah.
And that's really all we're trying to do.
Right. I also think that youth have been underestimated in terms of their faith.
Yep.
I had this funny experience when I was getting my doctor of ministry. I had to write a paper.
You got about 30 seconds.
I had to survey some kids at a coffee shop. And they came out of the woodwork to talk to me because they really cared about their faith.
Yeah.
And they wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, this is not a faithless society. It's just a little bit of a lost society, and we're looking for some help. We have very much enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Reverend Susan Cartmell. I hope you join us again. Thanks to all of you for joining us here on the Rational Revolution, WGBW, the Talk of Green Bay, 98.3 Oshkosh. Your support and the Civic Media app. We love you. See you next week. Thank you.